after I left last year, so I'm very happy to be here back. So my subject today is the numerical studies of graphity models, and it's mainly the new results are based on this paper over here, but the background material you can find also in those two papers with my collaborators Lee and also Fusini Marcopoulou and Simone Severini. So as a means of motivation and somewhat introduction, I want to explain what I mean by the title, and then I'll show you the outline, and then we'll dive into the main talk. So why would you be interested in graphs? As you all know, graphs in the forms of lattices like this are well known and also very useful. For example, in lattice quantum field theory, which is a respectable subject to study and has many applications, many good results. But however, in the case, if in the context where we're interested in a dynamical geometry, perhaps we would like to generalize the notion of a lattice to something else. And one class of approaches, which I call the triangulation-based approaches, do more or less the following. So they take a manifold and then they triangulate it in this in a way as shown here on the left-hand side, and then make that dynamical by allowing these triangulations to be not exactly regular as here on the left-hand side, but also allow more funky configurations like those shown on the right-hand side. Okay, and so many approaches like dynamical triangulations or quasi-dynamical triangulations, also spin forms, fall into this category. A different type of generalization of lattices is I'm showing over here, and I'm called them the non-triangulation based approaches. Here, what you do is you take the graph and you make it and you change it in a more radical way. So the graph that you see here on the left-hand side it does not correspond to any triangulation of any manifold. So this graph is more general than the graph that you see on top. And if you want, you can also add arrows to indicate some extra information or maybe causal relations. So it's up to you. And so many people study graphs of this type, for example, in matrix models or causal sets, etc. And so the purpose, my purpose in this slide is to show you that graphs in general are the precursor structure for many approaches to studying dynamical geometries. Graphy models, in particular, are a class of models that we introduced some time ago. And their main goal is to select the background geometry dynamically from the space of all possible graphs. So we would like to consider all types of graphs and have some mechanism to select the ones that represent manifolds or maybe lattice-like or triangulation-like from that space of all possible graphs. And so these models were proposed in these two papers. The assumptions that go into the definition of graphy models are the existence of a microlocal weighting function, for example, an action or a Hamiltonian. So you're all very familiar with using an action or a Hamiltonian to do defining a model. So this is not a big assumption. What is crucial for graphy models is the non-assumptions. We do not assume, or we did not assume, the existence of an underlying manifold in which the graph could be embedded. And we do not assume any that the graph is dual to any triangulation. Also, if you remember in the title, I promised the numerical studies. So why would you be interested in numerical studies of models like these? Well, you know that most models, including this one, is going to be defined in terms of a partition function, which has some sum over geometries, sum over matter fields, and then some weighting function inside. Observables are defined in this way as usual. And I want you to remember that except in very simple circumstances, for example, very simple circumstances, it is not possible to evaluate the partition function or the expectation values of some observables very quickly or analytically. And so therefore, you need to have some approximation methods, usually in the form of numerical methods, to study this. And you might be familiar that using numerical methods, in the context of quantum gravity did has been tried before. For example, in the context of spinform models, there has been some results on that. So I'm not drawing on any of what they did, but I just want to remind you that these numerical methods are sometimes necessary in order to push our understanding of a model further. So the outline of my talk is as follows. First, I will give you in more detail the definition of gravity models. If you've heard this definition before, I will remind you and I will stress what is going to be important for the next parts of the talk. If you haven't heard of gravity models before, I think you should get enough information from that in order to understand the rest. And the main new bulk of work that I want to present comes in this section on Monte Carlo simulations. And I'll describe to you the behavior of these models at high temperature and low temperature and how they transit between these two regimes. And I'll also show you pictures, essentially, of the characteristic graphs at the high temperature and the low temperature regimes. I will then tell you how matter degrees of freedom can change the behavior of the model, and then finally conclude. So this is the definition of the gravity models. So suppose that take the configuration space to be the set of all possible simple graphs with n vertices. So you want to take a complete graph with n vertices. And for each pair of vertices, you allow there to be an edge. So there is in total n times n minus 1 divided by 2 edges. And you want to put a label on each of the edges. The label will be 0 or 1. And the physical interpretation of these labels is shown over here. 0 will mean that there is no physical connection between the two vertices. And 1 will mean that there is. OK? So to understand that better, maybe this picture might help you. In the center, you see a complete graph. And the edges are drawn in dotted lines. OK? So what I mean by that is that these edges don't have labels attached to them yet. Once you put the labels on, 0 or 1, you can generate pictures like this one, for example. So here, some of the edges are black, some of them are white. And so you see a specific graph. This graph looks pretty random. In fact, it was generated randomly by looking at each edge in the complete graph and assigning the labels randomly with some probability, black, white. And here on the right-hand side, you see a different graph. This was not generated randomly. And you see that this graph has some structure. For example, the vertices are all three-valent. Also, you recognize some shapes like rectangles or pentagons inside. So in this, this graph is somehow special. This one is somehow random. And the goal of the gravity model is will be to generate graphs like these as opposed to graphs like that. But continuing with the definition of the model, here I want to note that it is possible to write all of this in terms of Hilbert spaces. So if you associate a two-dimensional Hilbert space spanned by basis state 0 and 1 to each edge, then the total Hilbert space of the model is the tensor product of many copies of this two-dimensional Hilbert space. And then in order to distinguish graphs, we are going to we assign an energy to these graphs. So if you have some Hamiltonian operator, you can evaluate its expectation value and call that expectation value the energy. And the choice of the Hamiltonian that you put over here defines a particular gravity model. In general, this Hamiltonian can have will have two pieces, H free and H interaction. H free is going to be it's called H free because it is an eigenoperator of graph states, and H int is not an eigenoperator. It takes one graph and transforms it into a different graph. So examples of interactions that are possible are shown over here. for most of what I will be talking about, you don't need to know how to represent these in terms of operators on the Hilbert space, although that's possible to do. All that is going to be assumed is that these interaction terms are local, and they also preserve connectedness of the graph. These are minor assumptions. And so if you just think that the interactions are given by those shown here, you don't lose anything. That's fine. Most of the action that I will be describing comes from this H pre part. Any questions so far? This H pre part is further going to be split into two pieces, HV and HB. V will stand for valence, and B will stand for cycles. I could go into detail about where what the general form these terms could have and what particular choices we make, but that's not so important. The bottom line is that if you use the graph T Hamiltonian to compute the energy of a graph state, what you need to do is apply this formula here. This formula has two terms. The first term comes from HV, and the second term comes from HB. What you need to know about the first term is that it is minimum when the graph is regular, meaning that every vertex has the same number of vertices, edges coming out of it. And the preferred valence of the graph is a parameter V naught that appears here. And that is a parameter, a number that you choose when you define your model. For the most part, I will focus on the class of graphs for which this condition is exactly minimized. This term is exactly minimized, so I will just concentrate on the V0 regular graphs. Within that class of graphs, you still have many other things, many graphs, and we want to distinguish between them. We want to discriminate between them. And so the second term does that. The second term has two sums. A is the sum over vertices, and L is the sum over integers. Inside the sum, you have these two objects. PAL is the number of cycles of length L at vertex A. And GB is a coupling function that depends on the length of the cycle. And this coupling function is given by this expression. And it has the property that this function is very small when L, the length, is small. And the coupling is also very small, very, 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 very small, when the length is large. And the coupling is medium-sized for lengths in between. And exactly where this coupling function is not very small depends on the parameter R, which is another parameter that you choose when you specify your model. So if you put this information together with this formula, what you need to know is that if you are given a graph state, you need to count the number of cycles and then multiply the number of cycles by some appropriate couplings. And the more cycles you have, the lower energy the graph will have. Okay, more cycles means less energy. And that is essentially due to this minus sign over here. All right? So that's the definition of the graph T model. You can study it like you study any other problem in statistical mechanics by defining a partition function. The partition function will have a sum over configurations, which are just the graph states here. And there is a Boltzmann factor. Beta is the inverse temperature. And EG is this formula that I showed you on the previous slide. As a bit of foreshadowing, I also want to mention that if you extend the basic model and include additional degrees of freedom, perhaps corresponding to matter components, the partition function that you would have would be different from what you see at the top. The new partition function would have an additional sum over matter degrees of freedom. And you would also have an additional factor over here inside the exponent. So this will be an energy that is assigned to the matter component. The second two lines here are just formal manipulations of the first line. So there's no new things coming out, but it's just nice to rewrite the first line in terms either as this or that. For example, if you remove this summation m and this factor over here, and you clump that all together into a factor small z of g, then you will see that the matter effectively changes the weighting of each graph by this factor of small z of g. Okay, yes?
Graph.
Yeah, so there's different ways that you could do it. So I didn't prepare any slides for this talk about how exactly you could do it. But there's different options. But this form of the partition function would be valid for all of them. So later on, I will assume something about matter, but that's later on. Yeah, so essentially, the small z reweights the Boltzmann factor by something. Okay? And if you take this small z and you put it inside the exponent, you have a partition function that is almost the same as this one, except that in the exponent, you don't have the energy. You have some more general criterion that is shown over here. Okay? And so once you have this or you have that, you can try to compute expectation values of observables. If you think that the model exhibits some different phases and has transitions, you can try to compute transition temperatures, et cetera. And since the goal of the Graphy model was to generate a manifold-like graph in some regime, then one of the primary questions that you'd like to ask and get answered is, does the Graphy model contain a phase wherein the expected graph state approximates a manifold? And so this is the main question that I want to ask and answer today. I should say that some properties of the Graphy model have been expected or known before. So for example, the existence of a geometrogenesis transition, a transition between two different phases in which in where one phase is for sure the graphs in one phase for sure do not represent manifolds to a different one, was already expected a long time ago. And more recently, we have shown that lattice graphs are local minima of these models, and these local minima are thermodynamically stable, but we didn't know whether these lattices are global minima or not. So that's an important thing that we didn't know about. And so far, it was difficult to answer that question properly because of certain difficulties, because of the complexity involved with cycle counting, and also the extremely large size of the configuration space. So there's a huge, huge number of possible graphs with n vertices. And so it is difficult to find the global minimum in that huge landscape of possibilities. However, in other contexts in physics, when people have encountered problems like these, they invented the techniques to deal with that. And the Monte Carlo simulations are a particularly well-adapted means to do that, to study these things. And so Monte Carlo simulations have two primary applications, which I will use today. One is to approximate a partition function and obtain expectation values for complicated models. And the second application is to that they can be used to optimize or minimize some function that you give. Okay, so and both of these things will be important for the Graphy model. So if you want to apply these methods to the model at hand, you need to first specify the model in detail. So you may need to choose what value of n, how many vertices you're going to be interested in. You need to specify the preferred valence that you want. You need to specify the parameter r, which will determine whether the cycles will be small or large. You need to specify the temperature at which you want to simulate at. And later on, I'll introduce the parameter mu, but for the moment, don't worry about it. The simulation also needs to have some starting initial state. And from that initial state, if you do the simulation properly, it doesn't matter what the initial state is. But you do need to give the computer some initial state. And then as the simulation runs, the simulation will change this graph state slowly, slowly. And if you run the simulation for long enough, it will be able to do both of these things for you. Okay, so then after you run for long enough, you need to collect and analyze the results. This middle step over here is what is complicated. So first you need to have a program that will actually do the thing for you, and then you have to run it. So I wrote a special program to do that. And if you want to play with it, either I can give you a demonstration of how it works later on today, or you can play with it by yourself. It is user-friendly, and you can find it attached to the paper here on the archive. Question?
Try this for many different initial states, to verify you're not in the local minimum.
Yeah, so I said that if you do the simulation properly, it doesn't matter what the initial state is, right? But in order to make sure that you're doing it properly, there's various checks that you can do. And so one of the checks is exactly what you said. You start with different initial states and see whether the simulation gives you the same answers. Yeah, so I did all of that. And so all the results, so from now on, I'll just show you the results. I won't go into too much detail about what tricks or what things you need to be careful about or what the potential problems are. So here are some results. On the top graph, on the vertical axis, you see the average cycle energy per vertex. And on the horizontal axis, you have beta versus temperature. So if you look at this part of the graph, or I should say that in this case, these numbers come from simulations with V naught equals to 3 and R equals minus 2.5. R minus 2.5 means that the cycles that are relevant lie between length equals to 3 or length equal to 9 or 10 or something like this. If you look at this part of the graph, you will see that for high temperature, low beta, the average energy per vertex is small. It's almost zero. What this means is that most of the cycles in graphs in that particular regime are very long. So when the cycles are long, they don't contribute significantly to energy, and therefore the energy here shows up as being zero.
Why is it negative? Earlier I was thinking that it was positive. Like this, it will, the way it was entering, it means that now it changes sign of whether the L is even or odd, right? So I don't think you wanted anything to be
okay.
Waiting negative.
So there's a couple of things. So why is it negative? Well, so I'm just plotting the cycle energy. So this term, which is always positive, I'm just ignoring because it's the constant. It's the same for all the graphs that I'm considering. And this term here is usually positive. Well, OK, it can be positive, it can be negative, and it can be zero, except that in that particular temperature regime, it turns out that the system wants to be near the zero temperature, the zero energy configurations.
P is just a positive number, right?
PAL are positive numbers, yes.
In the example, you've chosen G to be positive.
And
the GB.
And in most of the the GB, if R is positive, then GB is always positive. And then this whole thing is always positive, and then the whole thing is either zero or negative. When R is negative, then loops or cycles of even and odd length are treated differently.
Yes.
Yeah, but it turns out that for low temperature, that is not relevant.
Okay, so you the results of your simulations would be qualitatively similar if R was positive as well.
In terms of the pictures, in terms of these pictures, yes. Later on, the R positive negative will make a very big difference, and I'll also discuss that. Yeah. So in this regime, you have graphs with long cycles, and therefore they show up as having zero energy. And in this regime over here, you see that the energy is pretty large, well, it's lots negative. And you see that all of the curves kind of asymptote this, so there is a lower bound. Okay. And then there is a transition between them. The different curves correspond to simulations done with different numbers of vertices. So the leftmost curve has n equal to 60, and the rightmost curve has n equals 240. And so you'll notice that as the number of vertices increases, two things happen. The transition becomes steeper, and also the place where the transition happens shifts towards the right. Shifts to higher values of beta. Okay, so this is the result. Yes?
What do these simulations take?
Each point in this graph would take maybe a couple of hours. But if you want to just see the shape, then you can do it in maybe 30 minutes. But if you want to make sure that you get the right
what would use the error?
Yeah, the error, this graph actually contains error bars. But if you want to shrink them so that they don't show, then you need to run for long, obviously. Yeah. And so associated with this graph comes this graph. Here on the left-hand side, or plot, I should say, because I use graph too much. On this axis, you have beta, just as before. But here on the vertical axis, you have the specific heat normalized in some way. And what I want you to see here is that you have some peaks. And the peaks in the specific heat are usually associated with, divergences in the specific heat are associated with phase transitions. And so these peaks indicate that there might be a possible phase transition happening in the model.
Is there a simple reason why the specific heat scales like n squared?
There is. At the moment, I don't remember. But if you write the formulas, then you do need to divide by these n's. And I think it also depends on the particular definition of C that I did. But there is. And because of this normalization factor, if you were not to renormalize it like this, then you will see that the rightmost curves are much higher. Yeah. OK, so you see these are kind of magic results that come from the computer. But you can understand some of these features also analytically. And I'll try to show you how you could do that here. So it's very simple-minded thinking here, not very sophisticated. And the reasoning goes as follows. You write the partition function as a sum over terms that describe contributions of various classes of graphs. So the definition of the partition function is here. But now you want to split this sum over all the possible graphs to first a sum over graphs of a particular class, let's call it R. And that will give you a contribution Z of R. Then you look at the different class of graphs called L, and find the contribution Z sub L. And then you look at all the other graphs that don't fall into the class R or the class L, and call that contribution Z dot dot dot. Okay. And since you know from the simulations that there are these two regimes, you can choose ZR and ZL to describe the classes of graphs that are dominant in both in these two separate regimes. So R is going to describe contributions from random graphs, which are a class of graphs that are studied in graph theory, and many of their properties are known. And ZL are the low-energy graphs, and those are going to be one of the ones that are dominant at the low end.
How does it characterize the random graph in your context?
So random graphs, you study them by first you generate them by construction. So you choose first n vertices, and they're not connected. And then you sprinkle edges at random, but you have the constraint that each vertex must have, at the end of the day, a fixed degree equal to 3 or something like that. Okay? And so when you
generate
the balance, yeah. And so when you do that, you will find that most of the time you generate graphs that have some particular properties. And I'll show you an example of those, but some of these properties are that they're usually very bunched up close together. So the diameter of the graph is usually small. It's proportional to the logarithm of the number of vertices. Okay? So you have properties like that that you know. It is possible that when you do try to generate a random graph, by accident, you generate one that is almost lattice-like. But that is very unlikely. That is very unlikely. OK? And so in order to make progress now, we want to evaluate these two objects. And I did that over here. I won't go into too much detail about how that's done. But I want you to notice that there are two terms in each one of these equations. The first term comes about and it's proportional to the number of graphs in that particular category. So if you compare this term with that term, if you have V0 being bigger than 2, so 3, 4, etc., then this number is bigger than that number, meaning that there are more random graphs than there are low energy graphs. Okay.
Yeah, again, so how do you characterize the low energy graphs?
Yeah, so the low energy graphs are kind of by definition the ones that dominate here. Okay, so what I'm going to be doing in this estimate is that I'm going to choose the lowest energy graph and take that as essentially the unique graph that will fall into this Z of L.
So, okay.
But
is the important thing in that line log of the Z of L, is it the epsilon zero? Is that the content of that?
Right, so you have, let me get to that. Yeah, let me get to that. But one thing that I just said now that might have seemed contradictory from what before. So I said that just now that I choose the lowest energy graph and take that as the representative of all the low energy graphs of this class of graphs. And here you see that this number is not equal to 1 or 0. And that's because the vertices are labeled. And so for each picture of a low energy graph that you see, there are many different ways of assigning labels to the vertices. And so there's a lot of degeneracy there. And so this degeneracy is showing up over here. And then, OK, so this is for the first, these two terms. The second two terms are proportional to the energy associated with these graphs. So the cycle energy for random graphs is 0. And if it is not 0, it is negative for the low energy graphs. And so you will see that when epsilon naught, which is the average cycle energy per node in the low energy graph, when this is smaller than 0, as you saw it is, then this term here is bigger than this one over here. Okay. And so you see that between these two lines, the first term is bigger on the second line, but the first term is bigger on the second line. And so that is essentially the source of there being two phases possibly existing. Okay. So this is not supposed to be super convincing, but it is based on the observation that these two phases exist from the numerical studies. Okay. Once you have the estimates for ZL and ZR, you can plug that in here and try to calculate the transition temperatures. And there are more sophisticated ways of doing that and less sophisticated ways of doing that. The least sophisticated way of doing that involves just addition and subtraction over here. And it gives the same result as the more sophisticated way. So I'll just tell you that the final result is this one over here. And the important thing is that it is not a constant number, but it has this log n on the right-hand side. That means that the transition temperature scales with n. And so the transition temperature is 0 in the large n limit. So maybe this is not totally unexpected, but it is now you can understand it both through the simulation and through the these very rough estimates over here.
For larger n.
Yes, and so this is getting larger. Log n grows with n. And then don't get, so this is a negative number, but this is also, this is a minus sign, but this is also a negative number. Yeah, so it's okay, positive. Yeah. And it's
positive. More stupid, but we didn't invert to beta.
Oh.
Okay.
Another question, yes?
Did you indicate you didn't include any degeneracy factor at all for the low energy graph?
Yeah, this is the, essentially comes from the degeneracy.
So that's the labeling, but I mean, it's not a class of graphs, so that. Isn't it really a class of graphs? So shouldn't there be another term representing how many there are of that type or similar to that?
Right. So remember when I was describing this approximation here, when I defined the class of low energy graphs, it was my definition for low energy graphs. So I chose the definition of being the single graph which has the smallest possible energy. There are many others. That are very close in energy to the dot lowest energy one. And I put all of those into the dot, dot, dot. So I can show you maybe later that that the number that those ones that are close to the low energy graphs, you can understand analytically that they will not affect this result. Very much for large n. So I do have some reasoning that says that you can ignore them.
If you do ignore them, then it's sort of a foregone conclusion that the transition will be at zero temperature, because just the degeneracy factor, the entropy factor associated with the random graphs will swap
right.
One single low energy graph at any time.
Right, that's why it's not very surprising if you know your random graphs. Very well, yes, that's right. But you do learn something over here. You learn this this prefactor over here, which is something nice because it agrees within 20% of with the numerical data that I showed you before. And since these are all done, this is an estimate for large n, and I was using very small n in the simulations. And also because I ignored all of the other graphs with contributions here. It's sounds bad. Yeah, the question.
Yeah, I was just going to ask: is the degeneracy of the lower energy graph irrelevant because near zero temperature, it's not a function of temperature, so it drops out of the estimate for the critical temperature. That is, if the number to first order or second order as you change the temperature is fixed.
Yeah.
And it's not a function of the temperature. And therefore, it's not going to come into the balance that determines what the critical temperature is.
It is true that these numbers don't change with the temperature, and but I think that the main reason
but it seems to come, you know, because the n ln n term corresponds probably to the minus one in the lower formula over there, right? Mm-hmm. You know
that? So when you do let's treat this as the most naive thing you can try, and then try to do your thing later. So from the most naive thing that you can find, you see that the beta has to scale logarithmically with n. Okay. And then when you try to do what you suggested, keeping in mind that all the betas actually are log n, then, and if you look at the n dependence of each term, you will find that all the graphs that are close to the Lorentz state but not so close will be subdominant. By not by some constant factor, but by at least log n. Yeah. Okay.
Are you sure you're seeing the
asymptote? So that's why, because I'm not doing very large n in the simulation, that's why the simulation is allowed to be different from this by some amount. So I don't know whether this 20% is something that is too big from what it should be, or whether it's better than it I should have expected. But this is just empirical. The difference is about 20%.
Yeah. Can we assume the existence of negative temperature states?
So all the simulations that I did were with positive temperature.
Positive and it's like the definition of it, but maybe random graphs can give us the negative temperature distribution.
I didn't try thinking that direction. Okay, so far I showed you all of this stuff, right? But then you can ask, well, what do the graphs look like in these two regimes? So at the high temperature, these graphs have a small diameter. Well, the random graphs, they have small diameter and very few short cycles. And that's OK if the high temperature regime is giving you something crazy. But we're interested in what happens at the low temperature. And so this is what you find. Maybe it's not exactly what I was hoping to find, but this is the result. So the result is that the graphs are trees and chains. So when R is positive, the result is a tree. So you have a backbone, and then you have these small leaves. And all the cycles are hidden within these bubbles on the edges. Okay. When R is minus 2.5, or negative, you have a chain. So it's a one-dimensional long string, but it has these bubbles in between. And you can ask, why is positive and negative R different? And that is due to what Simone was saying, is that all the cycles are treated differently for these different sizes of R. And in the low temperature, in the high temperature regime, they don't matter, both of these values of R give you this kind of graph. But then the low temperature regime, they give you quite different results. Yeah?
How do you characterize this? How do you find this out with the data?
I run the simulation. And then when it finishes, or whenever I want, I say, draw the graph. And the picture comes up. Yeah. And then I save it, and I can show it to you over here. Yeah. So I see it.
I was wondering if you have a measure of tree lightness or plane lightness. So you just
No, I didn't. So you could invent something like that and calculate the some expectation value like this and derive this from the expectation value. No, but this is the actual output of the program. Yeah. And I should mention that when you change the parameters, so if you change the degree of the vertices or if you change these R's, this tree-like or the chain-like structure does not go away. It's always there. It's what might change is, for example, the shape of these leaves or the shapes of these bubbles, but the tree-like and the chain-like structure is always there. Okay. So, as an intermediate summary, I showed you from these simulations that there are these two different phases in quotation marks at low high temperature, but maybe not so optimistic thing is that the low temperature graphs are not our chain is tree-like, and they're not homogeneous and manifold-like graphs like I was hoping it would be. Okay.
The chain is pretty homogeneous. It's one plus epsilon dimensional.
Yes.
It's a fractal one plus. It's 1.2 dimensional or something.
Yes,
like
that's
that.
Right. But we were more ambitious before, right? So we wanted to have two-dimensional or three-dimensional structures.
Maybe it takes higher valence.
No. And so if you change the parameters, if you change the valence, or if you change the R. The parameters, any parameters of the model as it is, what you'll find is you'll still find a chain,
but the bubbles will be bigger maybe. Instead of having 6 vertices within that bubble, maybe they'll have 20 or 50 or 245.
So how does the size of a bubble scale with n?
The size of the bubble does not scale with n. The size of the bubble depends only on the parameter r.
So if you, maybe you mentioned that it's a three-dimensional triangulation, but say two-dimensional or three-dimensional triangulation, so Google graph of it has also galaxy 3. And the question is the new model somehow a generalization of the three-dimensional triangulation? So if you translate the action of the three-dimensional triangulation into this language of cycles, does it have something in the cycle?
Yes, the triangulations do have some cycle term. So when, essentially when you compute the curvature, it's like it's looking like a cycle, yeah. But the models are not exactly they're not equivalent.
And it's a different thing.
Whether the result is essentially the same or not, I'm not very sure.
And
so what I wanted to mention here is that the same type of problems arise also in other contexts. So also in the lambda triangulations, these non-manifold-like graphs appear. Also in causal sets, similar things happen. And so the people working on those approaches, they've tried to work around it or change the model somehow to get rid of the problems. But those solutions are not really applicable to the context that I'm talking about right now. And so instead of reviewing what these other people have tried to do, I will show you my proposal for the solution to this problem. And the solution, I don't have much time, so this is maybe the more interesting part, but it's going to be brief. The solution will come in two parts, solution A and solution B. Solution A is going to be ad hoc, okay? And solution B is going to be more physically motivated. So solution B is what you should, well, I hope that you will listen to. From a physics point of view, and solution A is good because I will be able to show you some pictures over here, and the solution A can be implemented on the computer. So solution A relies on changing the model somehow. So instead of using just this part for the partition function, I put in an extra piece inside the exponent. Mu is a real number, and V is given by this formula here. It's the variance of certain energies. So to compute this variance, you need to compute the energy due to cycles associated with each vertex in the graph, and then compute the variance. If the energies are all the same, the variance is zero, and this part just drops away. But when the graph is inhomogeneous, like tree-like and chain-like graphs are, then that variance will be high, and that variance is going to suppress those inhomogeneous graphs from the partition function. Okay, so you want to simulate the thing again with the large value of mu and see what happens, and the results are over here. The leftmost graph has r minus 2.5, just like the ones that you saw before, but instead of seeing trees or chains with bubbles, you see a much more homogeneous one-dimensional structure. Okay, so it's as Lee was saying, this is one-dimensional, just as the other one is one-dimensional. So maybe that's not too excited. It's not. You shouldn't be too excited about this case. However, if you look at other parameters, change the degree or change the value r, you can get something different. So, for example, if you look at this one over here. This graph has four edges coming out of each vertex. The parameter r is still minus 2.5. But in this case, you see something new. Especially if you look at this part, you will perhaps see a torus coming out. Okay, so a torus, it's a small torus, but it is one. And this is a start of the two-dimensional surface being generated by the model, as opposed to just a string or a one-dimensional surface. Okay?
So these are typical low-energy graphs when you have that extra...
These are the lowest ones.
Oh, this is the low. Okay.
Yeah. And which are the typical ones if you consider very, very low temperature. Yeah, zero temperature.
So the left one is a Möbius chip, right?
It looks like it, yes. But if you do some local move, interaction move over here, you will find just a normal strip, and it will have the same energy, it will have the same everything. So the model would not distinguish between them. It only looks like a Möbius strip if you fill in the rectangles with pieces of paper. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's... Other question?
Well, so I'm wondering to what extent our interpretation of these is dependent on the specific geometry that you've presented them with. Because, you know, in principle, there are no links. You know, they're arbitrary lengths associated with the edges.
There are no lengths associated with these.
Yeah, it's there or not.
Yeah, that's right. But if you think of defining a length in terms of how many steps you need to take to go from one place to the other, which is a natural notion of length on a graph, then this vertex is far away from this vertex there. So in some sense, the graph is extended. This is what I mean by saying extended. And in graph theory, this notion of length is used, so it's... yeah. And that is something that is good, I mean, good enough for now. Other question?
What happened to the tree and the other? Before you added this homogeneity, you also had trees.
Yeah, so if you take the model with the tree, so R minus plus 2.5, and and you do this, you also get this particular graph. So if you pump the variance requirement, the parameter mu, very high, it doesn't matter whether the R was minus or negative or positive. I'm not sure whether that is also true for all the other cases, but I think so.
The trees go away, basically.
Yeah. And the bubbles with the chains also go away. OK, so now here comes solution B, which is more physically motivated. And at the end, there will be some more complicated formulas. So in order to spare you those, I'm here presenting a warm-up solution B. And here, I would like you to consider the effect of matter on a box. So consider a box that has area A, and has lengths of size Lx and Ly. And these lengths of the box can change. They're not fixed by somebody else, but the box can be flexible. And you have a set of particles in that box. And so you write the partition function as the sum over possible box configurations, and then something inside. What is this set of box configurations? I'm going to assume that this set C contains a certain number, has some properties. For example, I'm going to assume that the square box is a possible configuration. And I'm going to assume that there is some minimal length L, and the most squished, long, and thin box that you can possibly have is the one that has Lx equal to small l and Ly given by A divided by L. A is always fixed, but Lx and Ly can change however you want. And in some, and if you were to look at the size of the set C, it's important that the size of the set C is growing, is depends on the area of the box polynomially. So, since I don't have much time, don't worry about this. It's not a big, at least in my opinion, it's not a big assumption.
what I want you to focus on is essentially this piece and that piece. This piece will go away because I will assume that EB is equal to zero, so don't worry about that. What's important is that there's a matter factor Z over here. And if you have one particle, this small Z is the partition function associated with that one particle. And if you have n particles, then you have to take this Z1, raise it to the power of n, and divide it by n factorial if the particles are indistinguishable. And so the partition function for the flexible box depends on the energy states for the individual particles. So the spectrum of the particles is important for the partition function of the box. If you look at normal quantum mechanics particle in the box problem in two dimensions, the spectrum is given by this formula here. And you see that the size of the box, Lx and Ly, appear explicitly in this formula. And what's interesting is to look at the minimal energy state for the particle for various boxes. If the box is square, the minimal energy is equal to zero. But if the box is very long and thin, the minimal energy is not zero. It is 1 over 8 mL squared. And so if you imagine that the minimal length is small and you want to take it to zero later on, this energy gap here is very large. So the energy spectrum varies dramatically whether the particle is in a square box or in a long and thin box. If you use this spectrum now and try to compute the partition function for one particle, you have to do some approximation, but you get something like this. And the L, the minimal length, which you imagine taking to zero, appears in these formulas. And so you find that this matter factor associated with the long and thin configurations is very much suppressed, very much suppressed. This matter factor coming from the square box is much bigger. If you raise this Z1 to the power of n, if you have lots of particles, this discrepancy between long and thin and square is going to grow. And so if you have sufficiently many particles, the matter can significantly alter the geometry of the flexible box. That's the bottom line. And what I mean by that is that if you define some observable shape and you look at its expectation value, and if you put a certain number of small number of particles, then the expectation value of this geometric observable is going to tell you that the box is going to be long and thin. But if you take a box which has many particles, then you can find that this shape will indicate that the box is square. So the matter, I'm glossing over some of these things with the CA alpha. but if you imagine that the number density of the particles is some non-zero number in this box, then you will find that the expected shape is square. And if you have an empty box, then the expected shape is long and thin. So the matter component changes the geometric observable hugely, I mean, as much as it possibly could. All right? And so yes. This is at non-zero temperature. Yeah. Any non-zero temperature. Sorry? Yeah, and so so there's two limits that I'm taking. A goes to infinity, and so imagine the temperature and A goes to infinity. If A goes to infinity, then for any temperature, this is true. But if you imagine taking that limit slowly, then the way this geometric observable is going to approach square is going to be slower for higher temperature, as you would expect. No. Yeah. Okay. And so solution B, the real thing for the graph model, is essentially relying on using this particle in a flexible box idea and applying it to the graph. Okay. Since I'm out of time, and I will skip over this stuff. But I want to tell you that if you include the matter in the model, so you add these matter component to the partition function, And if you choose the how this some various parameters in the that describe this matter component properly, if you just meaning that I found these two inequalities that you need to satisfy, then it is possible for the matter component to spread to act essentially just like the ad hoc solution A technique did. So it will take these tree-like or chain-like graphs and it will pump them out and create extended extended graphs. Okay, so that's it almost. Conclusions. So I want to remind you that these graphy models are designed to test whether the manifold-like structure of the universe is something that you need to assume in your model, or whether it is something that you can treat or hope to be an emergent phenomenon. And I've showed you Monte Carlo simulations that provide concrete information about how these models behave. And I try to argue that matter must play an important role in these models in order for the answer to this question to be that the manifold-like structure of the universe can be emergent. Okay, so if you want the manifold-like structure to be emergent, it seems to me that matter must play an important role. And so with this, I would want to leave you with a question. It's here. Will matter also have such an important effect on the model that you are working on? So I invite you to think about what matter does to your model, if in case you're not considering that right now. OK, so that's it. Thank you very much.
Very good. Any questions or comments?
So, yeah, there's this problem with basically the problem you're grappling with is you've got a very, very large configuration space with all kinds of horrible configurations, and you want this very small class of nice configurations to come out dynamically.
Yes.
And I know you're familiar with this fact that the number of the bad configurations, the proportion of those, goes up super exponentially with n as you go along. And then so the problem is that if you define a local Hamiltonian, a local energy, then it's hard to see how that can outrun the super exponential growth of the number of bad configurations. Now, in your solution A, I saw that you had a sort of global term, a sort of non-local term appearing in the action to get rid of that. In CDTs as well, there's this sort of global constraint, the causal constraint on the configuration. Mm-hmm. So in the matter, in solution B there, how are you going to beat this super exponential growth of the number of bad configurations? Is there some kind of, I didn't see any sort of non-locality. Is there some other kind of entropy that's going to come in?
Okay, so solution A and solution B are not related to this problem of super exponential growth of the bad configurations. Yeah. So the way you kill that problem is you don't kill it. You can avoid that problem if you that problem is essentially embodied in the fact that this transition temperature is proportional, is not a constant, but is varies with n. So if you increase the size of your system, then the number of bad configurations grows super exponentially, as you say, and therefore you need to drive the temperature lower in order to go to the low temperature phase. But even if you do manage to overcome that super exponential growth of these random graphs, you still need to have a model that selects low energy graphs that you like. So the very basic graphy model doesn't do that. It selects things like this. And in order to make things more extended, as you said, you need to have something that acts a little bit more globally than what is in the usual graphy Hamiltonian. So in solution A, there was a global constraint or a global object, right? In solution B, there is also something global because the particles know about the boundary conditions of the graph. Okay, the boundaries are far away from each other. So,
can you say a little more detail what the matter model was? I couldn't separate from that one slide?
Yeah, so
what form of matter are you adding?
So I am. So in earlier, somebody you asked whether how do you implement matter on these graphs, and I didn't really want to answer. In this case, also, I'm not using any particular way of putting matter on the graph. What I'm only using is the same amount of information due to graphs that came from in the warm-up exercise. The warm-up exercise, there is no dispute that this is the energy for a particle in the box. And it's essentially due to the wave function of a particle having some boundary conditions. Okay.
So is this quantum matter, or it's just classical matter at some finite temperature?
As long as the energy is proportional to the frequency, then it's fine. So essentially, that's all I'm using. Also, in the matter on the graph model.
So conceptually, is what you're doing? You're adding some unknown form of matter.
Yeah.
Integrating it out, and then including the resulting term in the.
Exactly. And the only thing.
You're just assuming that there would be some form of matter that does this.
That's right.
And not explicitly.
That's right. The only thing that I'm assuming that this matter thing, has is that the energy is proportional to the frequency. So that the lowest energy matter states have long wavelength. And then I ask, what graphs will have the longest wavelength? And that's the reason that goes on.
So conceptually, it's the zero point energy that's the energy that's proportional to the frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the zero point energy that's holding your space together, so to speak.
Something like this. Okay. The zero point energy is different for various graph configurations. That's what I'm using.
Right. Okay. So now I maybe this is an irrelevant issue, but I thought that the Casimir force is results from the change in the zero point energy from the geometry of which it lives, and it's an attractive force. So it tends to, if I have a box, it tends to want to collapse the box.
So I'm not sure what the relation to the Casimir effect is.
Oh, but you have the area. You have a constraint that the area is fixed.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So the question is: does the Casimir is this equivalent to what you're saying? Does the Casimir energy prefer? Is it most relaxed when the box is equal-sided as opposed to
yes
collapse for the same volume of the box? So that's
something. Yeah.
Okay. And because it's the Casimir energy. What's relevant, if this were true in nature, what's relevant is only the massless particles. So it's only the modes that are contributing the vacuum energy.
Yes, yeah, so the smaller the mass, the more they would contribute. Yes. But also massive particles. So in this equation here, the mass is not zero. Yeah,
so right, that's a non-relativistic formula.
Yeah.
Well, I think
So I want to come back to this question of length, because it's almost a circular problem here, because you're saying I'm going to start with a graph and I'm going to try to see whether I get a manifold structure so I can demonstrate some geometry.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to do that, you're having to make use of a length of of these edges of the graph in some kind of implicit manner. So you're saying if I have more edges, I've got a longer graph, whereas I can typically think of a graph as being it's topological, but there is no length. It's just I've got connection, and it could be microscopic or it could be enormous. It doesn't matter. There is no real length associated with it. So I guess I'm having this conflict and trying to understand how I'm learning whether I have a geometrical manifold structure without actually putting in the geometry, because I think you have put in the geometry.
Okay, so the final statement that you said, I disagree. But let me try to say more about... So the one observation that I want to make is that graphs that are random in nature, like this, mm-hmm. are different than the graphs that are like that. So these two graphs have the same number of vertices, But if you take my definition of distance, meaning hopping on the edges, then this vertex is far away from this, maybe, I don't know, 10 steps or 15 steps. Whereas if you choose any two random vertices over here, the same using the same definition of distance, you see that they're much closer together. And that this, the difference is going to be more pronounced as you take the number of vertices bigger than 36. Okay? So this is so already this model is allows you to differentiate between these two classes of graphs. Okay? The ones that are bunched up according to my definition like this, or spread out according to my definition like that. So that is what I want to convey to you. And now you can associate more or less importance to that observation. I think, personal opinion, is that this hopping on the edges to nearest neighbors is not a bad thing. I'm not saying that this graph has to be embedded in some manifold, and that manifold has some distance scale, some ruler, and that I'm not using the ruler from the embedding manifold to determine the distance. I'm using just the properties of the graph itself, the hopping distance. So I'm not really assuming anything in addition to the connectivity of the graph. And so if I have only the connectivity of the graph to rely on, I'm not aware of any other way of defining distance. So that's why I'm happy with the one that I was using. But if you have different ideas, then maybe we can discuss that.
Yes. One last question from
I wonder if you ever thought of approaching the question from the other direction. So here you're saying, let's choose some physically natural energy expression and see whether it gives rise to a manifold.
Yeah.
From the other direction would be, figure out what are some kind of invariants that will guarantee being near a manifold, and try to use them to build an energy from them. But to do that, you have to know some sort of tests or some sort of measures of manifold likeness graphs. So have you looked at those? Such thing? I mean, I know in causal sets there's no simple answer to that. These are just a little different. Have mathematicians considered such things that could give you a measure of just some invariance of the graph that would tell you how close it is to being a three-dimensional manifold?
So as far as I know, there is no simple answer to that. I know that there are some measures like the average distance or the diameter of the graph, but those, they tell you about the extendedness, but they don't tell you about the dimension. And so the original approach to defining this model was a little bit in the spirit that you described. We did look at lattices and see, okay, what is special about lattices what is special about them that is not present in other graphs that we see. And so we came up with counting cycles, lots of small cycles, except that that seemed like a good idea, but it seems that this is not enough. And so I tested that, and now we know that that is not enough. And you need to have some kind of more global term in your model that will spread these chains or these trees out. And although I'm sympathetic to looking at defining some invariant in graph theory and then putting it in over here and justifying it that this will give us the right answer, but at the same time, I would like to have to define a model that seems natural from its roots, so to speak. So here, what we use this locality in the graph sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think in two dimensions there are things that will guarantee having a planar graph, but beyond that, I don't know.
Yeah. If you're interested in higher dimensional spaces, you don't want planar graphs.
No.
Yeah. So.
It's again about repeating the language and the
yes.
Do you know what these kinds? I think it works out like a pattern, which probably lost most of the spin pattern.
Okay.
On the graphs, and whether it had to be solved, they had to be solved, they had one dimension there.
Okay, yeah. So this I forgot to mention. So. There's some recent work on putting Ising model type things on vertices of the triangulation, and I have a feeling that this is not going to be the same as what I was describing. But having said that, it was pointed out to me after I did this that there was some older work in the I think 80s or maybe early 90s about gauge fields on dynamical triangulations, and they have observed that the problems. I should have mentioned this, that the problems in the dynamical triangulations are less severe if the gauge fields are included. But this was somehow, I mean, it didn't really catch up.
Just to comment on that, there's a very disputed paper by a young person from Tokyo who claims that putting matter on Euclidean dynamical triangulations in four dimensions results in a geometrical phase. And Jan, at least, angrily disputes the conclusions of that paper, and so it's not maybe as well known as it could be or should be. So maybe it's given you results, maybe it'd be worthwhile trying to dig that paper up and look at it.
Yeah, I think Simon Kasparov did some things like that several years ago, too, but I don't remember
yes.
what the.
That was, I think, in lower dimension.
Two dimension.
Two dimension. Yeah. This is this result from Tokyo is in four dimensions.
Very good. Thanks for your remarks. Let's thank Thomas again.